Hi, everyone. We have a special episode today. We're joined by Lance Bell, who has a very important and distressing story. This is something that's been going on in his life for over two decades now. His brother and two other men have been locked up for almost 20 years. And this is the first of a series we want to do. And the big important question is, are these men innocent? Was there a huge miscarriage of justice here because of just politics and just like a railroading of the justice system that really shouldn't be tolerated? That this is why we're doing this episode. So this one's very serious. But yeah, so Lance, thank you for joining us today. I can't imagine what you've gone through with this. This sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Yes, thank you for having me. Can you hear me very clear?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yes, thank you for having me. And yes, it has been a nightmare. It's been 23 years now. So I was 6 years old when this happened. I'm 28 now. So my adult life, since I've been aware of the situation, it's been real turmoil for me. But I can just imagine how my parents feel, and my sister, and my family members that's older than me, because I was a baby when this happened. I was only 5 years old, going on six. So it's a lot of things I wasn't aware of until I got older.
So Lance, could you please take us back to how everything transpired?
Yes. Well, from what I know, because like I said, I was just 5 years old. Well, it transpired in 1996. They said it was a botched robbery, but in reality, well, I can't say reality. This is just me going off my opinion. I feel like that was just a personal thing somebody had going on, because it was no robbery. It was known that it was $10,000 still in the safe of the check cashing place where this happened. So This wasn't a case where it was a robbery, because nothing was took besides two men's lives. So I felt like that was personal. So this was in December 1996. So yeah, my brother was a teenager around this time. He worked at Old Navy, and he also went to school, art and design school. So a lot of places, we lived in Corona, in Corona, Queens. A lot of places where he went to school and went to work, it was outside of Corona, outside of Queens perhaps too. He went sometimes on the outskirts of Long Island to go work and places like that. So when this happened, he was actually home, and he had worked a night shift, a morning shift, you should say, where he had to be up early, get up in the middle of the night to get up to go to work early in the morning. So he was actually sleeping when all this actually did occur, December 21st. And then December 23rd is when they came and arrested my brother for this case and the two other men. One of the men, he got arrested the same day with my brother, and the other man, Rohan Bolt, he had got arrested 2 days or a day later coming out of a grocery store. So
are you still in touch with Gary Johnson and Rohan Bolt?
I'm not personally, but my brother is. They're all in the same facility together.
And how often do you visit your brother?
I just went to see him this past Sunday. I'll say at least two, three times a month.
And you told me when we spoke before, you told me that he's always given you paperwork. He's been researching this. So these three guys have maintained their innocence all this time.
Yes. Like I said, he always, since day one, like I went to see him with the paperwork situation. I went to go see him on two different occasions about two years ago. And he had told me, he's like, I'm sending some paperwork home because I got too much of it. So at the time, I really didn't know what it was, though. He just told me that it was paperwork. So when I got it, I just had it in the house sitting there. And then I remember our phone call I told you about when I came across the article that Hannah Riley wrote. It was the summer of this year, 2019, like around May, June. I've read that article, and then since then, I started doing my own fighting on social media and trying to bring awareness towards this case. So then that's when he told me, he said, all that paperwork that he said I gave you, that's a lot of my transcripts and stuff from his trial dates and yeah, just stuff like that, information like that. And oh yeah, certain websites that he looked up about, like when he was searching the law and trying to find out certain motions he could file within the courts and stuff like that. So it was basically a bunch of paperwork like that that had to do with that.
And this article by Hannah Riley, when was the first time you read this article from The Nation?
I want to say June of 2019.
So this article had been published for 5 years and you didn't even know about it.
Yeah, I didn't even know about it. I was so shocked.
Well, I read this article a couple of times, and Lev, you've gone through it a couple of times, right?
Absolutely. And it still just shocks me how many holes there are in this case that I really want more people who are in law enforcement or media to be exposed to.
So I'm talking to my friend right now. Do we know if the attorney general or the DA is in charge of this case? Do we know who's in charge of the case?
No, right now I believe the Queens DA, they just have voted in a new counsel. I think her name is Melinda Katz. So she gets sworn in January. So right now, as far as the DA and stuff like that, like that's up in the air. So until January, till next year, the beginning of 2020, when she gets sworn in office, and then somebody will be able to take control of the case and do something with it, move forward.
So we definitely want to find out which politicians are in the district and see who maybe at the local or national level could help us. Maybe someone from state legislature or the House of Representatives. So there's a detective referenced in the article, Detective Pete Fiorillo. Is that how you pronounce his name? Pete Fiorillo?
Yes.
So Pete Fiorillo is a detective that looked at this case, and he has a lot of misgivings about it. And he's been troubled by this case for a long time. And apparently he's like friends with other people involved with the case, or he's acquaintances with people in the case. And so when he looked at it, he had no intention of looking at the case to take it apart. But the more he learned about it, the more his doubts grew until he became convinced that the investigation and the trial were irredeemably flawed. So I think that is very, I would love to talk to him. Have you spoken to Fiorillo anytime recently or after you read the article?
Yes, I spoke to him. I'm actually close with him. As far as like, I could just call him on the phone and he'll pick up, or if he doesn't answer, he'll give me a call back. But I actually spoke to him after we spoke on the phone, and I gave him a heads up about what I was going to do and stuff. And he agreed. He said, if anything, if I arrange something to come up there to speak to you guys in person, he'll come with me and he'll speak then.
Well, then we'll definitely do that. We're definitely going to follow up. And I think that would be fantastic. And then there's this other person in the case, Marianne Bubelnik.
Is that Bubelnik? I think it's a Polish name. Yeah. That was one of the big holes that I noticed, where there was an arrest of a 20-year-old Jean-Marc Bigway, a Liberian immigrant who was dealing some cannabis. And whatever he told her was not what she ended up giving as a statement, according to him, where he just said that he just hung out with his friends and that's it. But according to her, your brother was flashing a gun and inviting this guy to join them in this horrible act. And this is not the first time that Ms. Bubelnik was in some murky waters. There was a man who sued the city of New York for wrongful incarceration, according to the murder case which she handled. So if you have somebody like that who is in charge of disseminating what the truth is, I would have thought that would raise some red flags, but apparently not.
Yeah, like a lot of stuff that was taken into the court by these people, like it wasn't credible. It had no credibility. But the climate of where New York City was around that time, and like I said before, I told him on the phone, Rudy Giuliani was mayor around that time. Mm-hmm. And this case was a huge case to him, I should say. And so he was just pushing the button. And just to know that they had somebody that they can charge for this case, that's all that mattered to them. They didn't care about what made sense or what mm-hmm. didn't make sense. They didn't bother to look into new evidence was bringing forth to them. They didn't bother with nothing. That's why I was a juror. That one juror, stuff didn't make sense to her. What she was hearing, what they was trying to say inside the courtroom just didn't make sense to her. And she had to go to the crime scene herself to get a look at what really happened. If this sound possible, like if that's possible, what they said, because it sounds impossible and stuff like that.
Well, there was also an eyewitness from a payphone who on the second time looked at the people in the lineup and he got your brother convicted. But according to the Innocence Project, eyewitness misidentifications account for almost 75% of all the wrongful convictions later overturned by DNA testing. So this was not even in the morning, right? This was just as the sun was starting to go up.
Yes.
So you're taking the word of somebody who was in the payphone 170 feet away in that dark of a climate to get some accurate information here. It's ridiculous.
And they were wearing hoods. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, the testimony that was the linchpin here was from someone who was pleading, who was already in trouble for a crime, and he was testifying for a special deal. And a year later, he was convicted, and he was a career criminal in and out of prison starting at 17. This is the testimony that this whole case relies on. And then he gets his special deal. When he gets out, he murders someone like a year later. And so this is the guy whose word this all depends on. And it's very shaky when you do add everything else up. So two people were murdered. So it's called the Davis Epstein murders. Mm-hmm. And it occurred during the Giuliani era. And one of the people happened to be a cop who was... He was working as security. And so this was at a time when Giuliani was building a reputation for himself as cleaning up crime. And he would say, if you shoot and kill a New York City police officer, the police department is going to catch you. They're going to find you, usually in a short period of time. And then at a minimum, you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail. And in this particular situation, it's quite possible you'll get executed. And so this is what Giuliani would tell reporters. And this is what he told reporters after a conference regarding these murders. So you're exactly right. Giuliani specifically was pushing the button on this case. And let's see, according to police reports, the NYPD officers stopped 6,000 cars and interviewed more than 1,000 people looking for anyone with outstanding warrants. And they put posters up all over town offering a $10,000 reward for information about the case. So, you know, I think a lot of people in this day and age, a lot of people watch Netflix documentaries or they listen to podcasts like Serial and things like that, you know, and even still, a lot of people grew up with CSI and crime dramas, forensics, detectives and things like that. And you hear all these stories of coerced confessions, false confessions, where you grab someone up who's very young, he doesn't know his rights, it's like 4:30 in the morning, whatever time it is, and you got these guys threatening you and putting a piece of paper in front of you and saying, sign this piece of paper and all of this will end, right? They didn't record their interrogation. There's no record of the interrogation. but they've got this signed piece of paper, and George Bell, your brother, has said that it was a coerced confession, which does bring its validity into question. And you can see with the frenzy that was surrounding this case that they were really just trying to strong arm and railroad this through. And I think that's what Detective Pete Fiorillo, who's a like career professional, I think that's what he also believes in his heart. It's just the evidence does not justify these convictions. I think it's just a matter of getting people to read this article, getting the right people to read this article, talking to Pete, talking to the other detectives, doing a couple interviews. Why not? Why not try to get Kim Kardashian or someone to look at this, or someone with connections in the police department or with political connections? I think we should have the highest standards for justice. And it's unacceptable to me personally to be aware of a story like this and to feel like Lev and I can make a difference, and for us to not help amplify this to the absolute extent of our abilities.
Yes.
So to think that the two people here was a young man who was working at Old Navy and a 35-year-old owner of an East Elmhurst Caribbean restaurant who's also a father of two. Those do not seem to be very likely murderers.
Yo, everything, I don't mean to cut you off. That's because that's the second time this happened. Everything you said, I said the same thing to myself, because you see how he was just saying, your partner was just saying about how this guy had he had a history. He had a history. He was a career criminal doing this and doing that. If you look at George don't have no history. He didn't have no history. He went to school and he went to work. And he just liked to buy clothes and that's it. He liked to have different girlfriends, and that was it. He didn't even care about cars. He liked to take trains. You know, in the 90s, the trains was fun and stuff like that. Plus ticket, you know. But when you even look at his background, then you try to wrap your mind around how did he just become a murderer overnight? It does not make sense.
No, of course not. And the guy, the other cryptic thing here is you have the owner of the check cashing place, Ira Epstein, who told his wife on the day that he went out that he knew that he would never see her again. That's what she told the press.
Oh, yes. And then that's the thing. Why would you feel like, why does he have to tell, why does he feel like that? Like, what made him feel that he would never see you again? Oh, you know what I'm saying? And then it's good that she said that publicly too. That's on public record, because that's telling you that he was in fear of his life for whatever reason.
That's right. And then he was killed in the store while he has this police officer as security, and there was $10,000 left behind, so nothing was stolen. So it wasn't a robbery. There was no robbery.
Yeah. And then in the beginning of my set, they said it was a botched robbery gone wrong. Nothing was going wrong. It was never no botched robbery. It was that they just That was just
it sounds like the wrong place at the wrong time. It really sounds like the wrong place in the wrong time.
Yeah, well, like for the guy to say that it's a possibility I might not make it home tonight. He was in fear of his life, right? And so I believe it was meant for him, and the security that was a cop, an undercover cop at the time, he was the innocent bystander. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, because I believe they probably was going to do that to the security guard either way. Mm-hmm. And then I also question, how come he has security? But then that's when somebody tried to tell me, some check cashing managers work with security and stuff like that. I was like,
How safe was that neighborhood during that time?
I don't believe it was dangerous at all. I don't know, because I wasn't old enough to live it. Mm. So to be there and understand.
Well, this is a little bit after the, as they call it, the bad old days of New York City, which I think reached its peak at around the time when we got here. I originally came from Russia, from St. Petersburg, Russia, and my grandma almost got robbed one time when she was walking around Foster Avenue where we used to live. And that was around 94, I believe. So,
yeah, 94, that was. Yeah. Foster Avenue, what's that? That's Brooklyn?
Yeah, that's Brooklyn.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Not a great place to hang around, especially at night. But that's why I'm very divided when it comes to the implementations that were made by Giuliani. Because on one hand, we did end up having a safer city. I mean, right now New York's like Disneyland, and back then, since it was so dangerous, I could see why certain policies like that ended up working. But the problem is that when you have this, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the term collateral damage because it sounds so, you know, so clean, while really it's anything but. But I just think that that kind of stuff, the short-term thinking, just because you're trying to, you know, because you're trying to show everybody how good of a mayor you are, it's going to backfire in terms of the lack of trust that communities are going to develop as far as their relationship with the police go.
Yeah, look at Mike Bloomberg. He just apologized the other day. He said, I apologize for the stop and frisk policy that he had going on for about 5 years, I believe, or something like that. He said, I didn't realize how much damage it could cause to families. So it's like, and now he want to run for president.
Because here's the thing, that even with the Giuliani thing, his legacy is strongly contested. You know, the book Freakonomics has a whole chapter dedicated to saying that Giuliani actually didn't do anything to help the city, that it was all just PR and, like, you know, headlines and things like that. But if you look at the source of the crime drop, it had a lot more to do with birth rates. That's what Freakonomics says, which is, according to a lot of people, that is the authority on the reality of Giuliani's legacy. At the end of the day, I think it just really comes down to morality. And, like, we have ideals. And I do love how this article ends. Like, having one innocent person locked away is inexcusable. And there was that case recently that was being talked about, this Rodney Reed case, which is a lot more questionable than this. This case has nothing to do, like Rodney Reed, they were scrubbing his criminal history, like all sorts of other problems that he had, just because they were anti-death penalty, right? They were trying to create a news story to get him off because they just don't believe in the sentence. But they were completely manipulative with how they were re-presenting him. And none of that is going on here. This is a very straightforward story about a miscarriage of justice. There's no ulterior motive here other than we became aware of this story by chance, by randomness, through the universe. We came across this story. I found your social media, and, you know, we've given it some time. We've looked through it, and I was just scratching my head going, like, wait a second. Like, I feel like it's my duty. Like if I believe something to be injustice, as I've gathered from this story, with my familiarity with this case so far, I just feel compelled to speak up, because what the heck is going on here? It just seems like, because of its political background, that people have not been motivated to touch it yet, because they're thinking about their careers in politics or in law enforcement, and they're not just thinking about people's lives.
Yes, you hit it right on the head, because that's exactly what it is. Because you see how you mentioned Kim Kardashian, this person. But then it's like, once these people view it, and then once they see, it's like when everybody sees that it's a cop, nobody wants nothing to do with it.
Well, I think that can change. I think especially when you have this detective who's an NYPD detective who's also amplifying his misgivings. I think it's time to get some new blood to look at this. Mm-hmm. It says a lot that this article was published in 2014 and Lance, George's brother, didn't even know about it, right? You didn't even know about this story for 5 years and here it is. And Hannah Riley has laid it out very meticulously here. And I think it's time to say what's up. And that's what we want to help you do. What would you want our next steps to be? What can we do to help you beyond what we're currently doing?
Exactly what we're doing right now. We're just taking one step at a time, because as we go on, it's going to, the story's going to get out there to more people. I just feel like we want to talk about my brother's personality, him as a person, because even though he went through this and still's going through this still to this day, he still remains his innocence. He still remains his sanity. He still remains healthy. He keeps his mind occupied. He stays busy. And he's still the same person, even from when he was home. Like, he didn't change. Mm-hmm. He's still... I'll show you pictures of him. Or I showed you. You can look on my Instagram. Like, he still dresses nice. He doesn't let things get him down or make him look sad or make him look mad or angry. He's real. Got it intact right now. He's got it intact. And I just want to talk about him as a person. And, yeah, definitely how he's wrongfully convicted right now.
He's never had any disciplinary problems.
Yeah, no tickets, no nothing since he's in there.
And even since he's been in, he's never been in the box. He's never had problems, right?
Yeah, no, I got his track record of everything that he's completed of since he's been incarcerated. Wow. Stuff that he's obtained and things like that.
This is such a tough story. Well, I definitely, we are on this. So thank you, Lance, for joining us and for sharing a little bit of your story. I'm sorry for this nightmare you and your family has been going through for so long. I really look forward to talking to the detective Pete Fiorillo, and would love to try to talk to the author of this article, Hannah Riley. And I mean, even if we could talk to Marianne, Lev, you pronounce it Bobelnik?
Bobelnik. I didn't find anything on her online. Yeah, I don't know where she is.
Yeah, she's defunct.
I don't have her information either.
Yeah, she had a lot of cases overturned. Apparently there was a lot of malpractice. And it does seem to me to be an irredeemably flawed case. And I think we have to do something about it.
Yes. Yes. And I appreciate you for having me. And next one, we're going to do a video. Like I said, this was just a warm up for me, but yeah, I have no problem with doing a video. And yeah, thanks again.
Thank you, Lance.
All right. We'll talk soon. Have a good night.
All right. Have a good night.